5, side 1, continuing our interview with Mr. Nathan Snyder.
As I was saying, we had those site troops who were going, the sentries alongside from the left and from the right side, guarding us with the rifles, with the bayonets up. And that I rejected. Mm-hmm. Not only I, we all resented that and rejected that. How come we are going to fight the Nazis? We're going into the battle, going down to the embarkation point to go to the front line. They have to be guarded. And we resented it very, very much. They felt like they are prisoners forced to go sacrificed for the war. Mm-hmm. And my aim was to escape.
Is that so?
Yes. And I figured, I want to fight the Nazis. I want to take revenge. But not that way, not this way. I did it before my duty under different circumstances. But they didn't have any trust because too many were deserting. Mm-hmm. So they had no choice, be sure that no one escapes from that group. So as we came into the railroad, and I remember that we were going, the irony of that is that as we were marching down, because it was like a hill going down downhill, we were singing patriotic marches, songs. Patriotic songs like Stalin fighting the Nazis and so on. But we have guards on the side, we shouldn't escape. So that's the irony of that. But then we arrived there, here where the commotion started. Disorganized commotion. Trains coming back with prisoners of war and wounded Russian soldiers, and tanks and supplies and trucks and troops going to the front. And we were there stationed in one place. And then finally that train came with the cattle cars and so on. And naturally, they had attached us to each 20 or 30, I could remember, into what the train. They gave us supplies and so on. But my aim was to escape. And from that day on, I lost contact with my friends, with my Jewish friends.
They were in other groups?
The other groups attached, and they apparently went ahead, and I'm the one who did take off. When I entered from the front, and I exited from the back, make believe that I'm going to the bathroom, naturally, to relieve myself, if somebody asked me. I was relieving myself not only for 5 minutes or 2 minutes, but I relieved myself standing there for about a half hour waiting for the train to leave. So in case they see me, I says, look, I'm doing my duty. Mm-hmm. And finally the train took off. Mm. And I am here stationed.
What is the city now?
Chernivtsi.
Oh, Chernivtsi. Chernivtsi.
Yeah. The train took off and I says, fine, at least I'm away from that group. But this is no way of saying they wouldn't attach me to another group.
But you're surrounded by Red Army people.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Oh, sure. Troops all over the place. And they have those army, railroad MPs and so on. They call them Vojennaya Militia or Vojennaya NKVD.
It was the KGB.
It was the army KGB, which, So finally, I had to report to the, because I was in uniform, so I couldn't just walk away. I went to the commandant and I told him and reported and says, I lost my train. So he said, what was your group? And I don't recall, but I gave him the name of the group. He says, no problem. On the next train, you join him. Or you go attach it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So he said to me, wait here. So I waited in his office. And I was sitting down, and I said, wait. And as I was waiting there, I figured, well, that's my destiny. Nothing I can do. And he said, aren't you deserting? I said, no. Mm-hmm. I went to relieve myself. The train took off. I was whistling and screaming and howling, but it was too late. I said, well, there's so many trains coming through. I said, no, those trains which are coming through, our supply trains, you are not allowed to go on those trains. You have to go with troop trains. He was
watching you.
Not watching
me.
He was riding, making telephone calls, people were coming in, coming out.
Oh.
And then
he got busy.
After about a half hour, he walked out from there He left me alone then. And another officer came in. Don't remember if it was a higher officer or a lower officer, whatever it is. He came in a very good mood, smoking his cigarette made from newspapers, usually with a bit of the cut tobacco, which we naturally all smoked at that time, and whistling, and he says, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm waiting to go back. I'm going. What do you call that? Furlough.
On furlough.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, another story.
Yes, I'm going on furlough. I'm going on furlough.
Oh my.
He says you cannot go on furlough on an army train, which goes back. That's going back hinterland. He says, nah, it's the army secrets. You cannot go on a train like this. I says, but I was promised. Says, I'm sorry. You just have to go on your own. Leave and go on your own. I says, thank you very much.
Oh, my word.
So I walked out, and I went out.
You didn't need a pass or a paper or something?
It was a very big confusion. I walked out from there. From that, the station, the office was like near the main road, like.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guardrail over there, and there was so much commotion because trains coming and trains going. Mm-hmm. And that time a train with prisoners came in, they had to give them the water and bread and so on, and guard them and so on. So I just walked out from there, and I was not running, just walking slowly to town. And, well, I had paper with me that I am a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody stops me, I figured I'm going to say that I lost my train, and I'm lost. I'm lost. I remember another thing, going back to that, while we were actually under, this is prior, like a month or 2 months prior to that, we were asked to escort a train of German prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And we went about 40 or 50 miles into close to the Polish border, which was in Galicia, because when escorts, they did not go the whole way. Like the trains originated, let's say, in Budapest,
mm-hmm.
or in Warsaw, mm-hmm. or wherever it is. Those escorts did not go from them up to Donbass or to the Caucasus. They went 50 miles, and another escort took over, and another escort,
mm-hmm.
and so on. This is the way it worked.
Mm-hmm.
So we took over a train to escort it over, actually, fresh troops who came from the front. And another day I felt bad because they were mostly young guys. So after about 7 or 8 hours traveling, they stopped in a small station, a small little town, which was a railroad station, where they, from a humanity point of view, they had to supply them with food and water. And there were population standing over there. Some women, some children. I don't think they were Jews, because there were no Jews living in those little towns. But to show them the sympathy with the Russians against the Germans, they were against Germans now. This is the way the Ukrainians are. So the train stopped, and then they had over there big buckets of water, like big buckets like for horses. And they had this heavy bread, which was half sawdust and half bread, brown, and it was like long. And in each cattle of them, in each car, they were thrown in like, they were packed.
Mm-hmm.
They were thrown in like 10 breads and 2 buckets of water.
Mm-hmm.
They don't deserve better. And so what happened is they opened the doors. They were like sliding doors.
Mm-hmm.
So they opened the doors, first of all, for fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And they had 2 bars in front of them, 2 bars, like horizontal bars. And this is where they were standing over there. And I, being as a Russian soldier, looked there. And I'm facing in here. They're all in young, 15, 16, 17 years old. They came fresh from the front because some of them even had mud still on their hands, on their feet, on their faces, bandaged. But they were all naturally prisoners. And a lot of them in black uniform. They were mixed black and gray uniform. the population who was standing from the outside were cursing them. Mm. You Nazi, you murderers, you Nazi, you murderers.
The previous year.
And I will never forget that. Mm. Here they are, German prisoners, I'm talking about the SS, youngsters or brainwashed, who are standing here on a train, a Russian train, who's going to their destiny, which they didn't know where it's going, but it's going back east. Mm. They are prisoners. They're given bread and water. The population's here against them. And they stood up, all of them, especially on that train. I'll never forget this picture. What fanatism can do to a human being, fanatism. Stood up with their hand raised, and says, long live the Führer, Heil Hitler.
Oh my.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes. So brainwashed with those Germans. No wonder they fought the last day, the last man. No wonder they were killing by order. Mm-hmm. Long live the Führer, Heil Hitler, in German.
In German. On their way to their deaths, and because all the prisoners were shot.
Because I understand this. When they went back into the Russian territory, those in gray uniforms were taken away. They were actually separated from the SS. The SS were all killed, machine gunned. They used to bring those cattle trains into to the Donbass or Caucasus in the mountains. They didn't used to kill them, they used to dump them down into the ravines because they were the biggest enemy. I mean, revenge is revenge, you know. And I don't think they deserve better because they were all killers. But anyway, that picture I will never forget, what fanatism is. And I was at that time 18. They've been maybe 17, 18. Mm-hmm. But if you are a prisoner and you lost the battle, at least say I'm sorry. I don't know. They provoke.
Know when you're...
Right.
When you're
no, the Russian didn't do nothing, the Russian soldiers, because they were used to that. Apparently when they captured them, they were used to it. But the population was outraged. So they try throwing stones and everything on them. So they closed right away
the doors.
We escorted them to about 20 or 30 miles to the next, and then another group took them over. I personally had never an animosity. I felt in a way, I had a human side in me. I felt bad because they were young and they were...
Doomed.
But I mean, I would not say I'm going to take revenge and go and kill half of them, but I felt bad for them, in a way, wasted life. Mm. But I was satisfied, one thing, that they won't do anymore what they're supposed to do, because they're already incapacitated. And at least they're in good hands, because if they will fall into the American hands, I'm sure they will give him some chewing gum, chocolate, some blankets, and the denazification, and maybe in 2 years be out in the street, but not with the Russians. So it's a shame that not all the German prisoners, Nazis, I'm talking about criminals, SS, did not fall on their hands. Then they wouldn't have been today neo-Nazi organization all over the world. This was one episode, as I remember. But getting back to that, when I left, that was my last time I had a uniform on.
You went to your home?
I went AWOL.
You went AWOL and then you...
I went AWOL because I figured... No, I'm not saying that it was the last time I had my uniform on. I'm sorry. But it was the last time that I ever went. I wasn't volunteering, but not under escort going to fight. So I took a chance and...
You made it.
I went back. I couldn't go home. I was afraid to jeopardize my uncle and my mother and aunt.
Were you afraid that you would be searched?
I was afraid that in a couple of days, I didn't know how organized they are.
Yeah.
But I figured they were not organized.
But you were afraid?
Afraid they have my list. It's so organized that they have a list and they know where they're going to look for me. But it wasn't so.
So what did you do then?
I went to a cousin.
In Chernivtsi.
In Chernivtsi.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, right away, took the uniform and took it off and burned it. And he said, you know, you cannot be here because they catch us, they kill us too. I said, why did you run away? He says, and I told him the whole story, you know, that's nonsense, you know. In the meantime, more news are coming back from friends, we knew, neighbors, mm-hmm. their sons fell, father and son fell, you know, together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was massacre going on the front line. We know the battles over there. So I was there for a, then I went from another place and I went a couple of weeks there. And one day I was going to Zonio Grill, who was a dentist. And he was already at age at that time. He was like 45 years old, and he had a dentist. They needed dentists because he was working also for the officer, for the soldiers. So I went and hiding in his place. And as I was going on the road, I got stabbed.
Mm. You were in civilian clothes, of course.
Sure, I was stabbed. And no question. They didn't ask me even for documents. They just hired me together with another group of guys. And they took me in to the same place from where they started from the beginning. Like I mentioned before, if five are missing, five are going to capture. I was...
What story did you give them this time?
Nothing. I says, what are you doing? They took me. You know, they, first of all, he says, where are you going?
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I'm going over. I says, why aren't you in the army? I says, well, I'm going to the army. You know, I was young. Why aren't you fighting? Because you didn't see any men in the street. The only man you saw was 80-year-old men and mostly women. No men in the street. No youngster or children who were 9, 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
No male. So naturally, it was obvious. So, and they were the patrols. They were not the NKVD,
mm-hmm.
the KGB. Police. They were regular military police. They were rounding up men for the front. So they took me in. And where they took me? To the same place from where I started in the beginning. And here starts a new chapter completely, because when I came in there, I found over there, guys told me he would run away 2-3 times if they captured him again. Ukrainians, Jews, Poles, all kinds.
That was an old story.
And even Russian soldiers who told me that they went as far as Kharkov,
oh,
and they were brought back and back and forth and back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going.
So, here started another chapter of my story. And that is a very interesting chapter, because I will never forget this chapter. And maybe this is the reason I'm alive today. But coming in there, naturally you have to register. My name was Schneider. So my name was Nathan. You always have a middle name there. Your father's name is a middle name there. So they gave me the name, naturally, right away, Natasha Yakubovich Schneiderov. Yakubovich was his middle name. And they attached me to a regular infantry group.
Mm.
It means cannon foot. They were older guys, guys in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 20s, in the 18, in the 30s, all kinds of groups. And they gave me another uniform there, and another provision over there. And we were not under guard because it was a three big army camp. That army camp was an old Romanian, like I mentioned before, an old Romanian camp, caserne, they mm-hmm. call it in German. It was built in such a way, in the middle of the city, it used to be, from the First World War, it used to be for the cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
They had, on the lower level,
mm-hmm.
they had stables for horses
mm-hmm.
in the Austro-Hungarian Wars, in the First World War. It was formed in a way like a U.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one wall, two walls, three walls. In front was the entrance, the big gate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge inside the housing in the second floor and third floor and fourth floor up to the basement and then lower sub-basement. This is where the stables used to be. And there were there, I would say, at least 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to bring in more and from there to depart more. Oh, yeah. They assembled us over there and they assigned us to a group, and that group was housed in those three sections over there. They gave us the provision, and we were sitting. I remember it was a big room. There was no benches, no beds, no nothing. And I was in a lousy uniform with some felt boots, shaved in my head with a fur head on my with a little satchel with provision. Naturally, I had my No, I did not. They didn't give us the weapon at that time, because the weapon is going to give us as we come to the train and we are attached to the regiment. They give us the weapons. If we had no weapon, we are then only recruits, like we call it, recruits. And I was sitting there on the floor, and it was nighttime. There was one little bulb on the ceiling, a very depressing scene. They were there about 30 in the room. And I was the only one Jew. They were all Ukrainians, and Poles, and Russians, and so on. And as I was sitting, they knew I'm Jewish. By my accent, or by my name, or by my face, but they knew I'm Jewish. And we were talking, and said, oh yeah, we're going to go in there, and who knows if we're coming back, and it's bad. And somebody says, oh, I like to go and fight, and all kinds of stories, like men have stories to say. And one guy sits across from me, said to me, you know, you stinking Jew. In a smile, he says, you know, when I come to the front line, the first bullet, I've been behind you, he said. See, I said, shooting the Germans, I shoot you first. I will be behind you and I will give you the first bullet in your head, in the back.
And here's somebody in the Russian army now.
Right. And I said to him, why would you do that? He said, because you're a Jew. You're a stinking Jew. It's called in Ukrainian, it's called Parshivy Jid.
Stinking Jew.
And I resented it a lot. I said, here is a guy who's going to fight with me, who's worked with my camaraderie and war. He's going to shoot me in the back. He says, shooting the Germans, he will shoot me. So I don't understand that. So I made an excuse to go out like to the bathroom, and I went and reported it to one of those officers outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I saluted and I said to him that somebody made a remark and called me a stinking Jew, and he said, don't pay attention.
Disregarded.
He was a Jew hater too.
He was a Jew hater.
Yeah. So I figured there's no sense going somebody higher. I think he wasn't a lieutenant, he was a sergeant or sergeant major or whatever. It doesn't make sense to go up higher, because you go to up higher somebody, maybe the same way. Don't care. He needs bodies. So I let it go with this way. But I took one aim, my goal, to escape.
Again.
And that was my aim. Now, you must understand that when I was, and after we graduated from the school, like I said, from that mine school, from that demolition squad, we gave us grades.
Mm-hmm. Ranks.
Ranks. Automatically,
mm-hmm.
because we had educational course.
Mm-hmm. And you were technically trained.
Yes, I became a sergeant major or whatever you want to call that, which I had three epaulets in here. This is original.
But you threw those away?
Oh, yes. And here I was a soldier.
Yeah.
You know, no epaulets at all. The epaulets were naked. But I had three epaulets in here. So I figured, escape. This was like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. We were told that around 8 o'clock they're going to march the whole band, empty that, because they're waiting for more recruits. I said, good. So now I'm going to see, I said, figure like this. When I walked in through here, I saw they have sentry in front. This is the building. And I figured, there's no way you can walk out from there. And going from the train again, maybe someone recognized me, I had to find a route, escape route from here. So what I did is I started going out. There was like 3-4 floors. New people sitting there, and some were playing balalaika with a guitar, and here there were singing groups, and some, you know, all kinds sitting together. And everybody knew that tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, they're all gone. So what I did is I started going around looking for ice cream. I wanted to research the building. I wanted to investigate where I am. I'm free to go there. No one stops you. Not realizing that when I walked out from there, another dozen went after me. Ukrainian. Not that Ukrainian who made a remark to me that
just because you were a Jew, or because
just walking after me.
Walking after me.
Yeah. Why am I going? So they walked after me.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody, they had a sense of whatever it is. It must have been about 8 or 10 walking after me. It didn't bother me walking after me, because you're free to walk around. After all, you're not in a concentration camp. And I was walking down. I was going down. I figured from up, it's impossible. Go down. Down basement and then sub basement. And there's stalls the horses. They were the horses, not the horses. You could even feel the still the smell left from the horses from so many years.
Mm.
Yeah, there was no straw, nothing, but there were the stalls the horses supposed to be, with partitions like. And I'm going over there, and it's ancient. It must be 200 years old, that camp, diving camp. So I'm going around, looking around, and I see that every window, which you look, the tiny little windows, is, you could, no, it's naturally flat, but you look out, it's very low. I mean, somebody walking, you only see his heels. So I'll be walking around, and I see those guys behind me.
Mm.
And I said, where are you going, guys? He says, where are you going? I says, where I'm going, I'm just walking around. He says, well, where are you walking around? He walked with you.
They wanted to escape, too.
Mm-hmm.
So now you had nine.
They were all young guys.
So
I says, I don't know you guys. I says, you don't have to know us. And you think they get stupid, you want to go and die there like flies? So, for some reason, we had some confidence in each other, because I figured, well, what a
together,
sense to get it in it.
Yeah.
So, I get going, and it goes around this way and that way, and it's like catacombs, and in and out. And so finally, we came to a big, big, grand door, with three, four steps going up to that door, and it's a big, old iron door. The door must have been about a 2 tons weight, but rusty. And across the door is a big, heavy, maybe that alone weighs about 1,000 pounds, big bar. And that bar, in the end of that bar, was a big, old-fashioned, must have been from the Kaiser Franz Joseph, from the Austro-Hungarian, a big lock the size of this tape recorder. Old-fashioned. So I looked in it, and they looked in it, and I said, I wonder what is behind that door. So I figured, why should I use my muscle? I said, guys, you want to start ripping that lock and the muscles, and they ripped and twisted and twisted, and that lock was snapping off. And then they took that heavy bar. About two people had to lift that bar aside. And here I'm facing two, there were two doors, like big iron doors. Yeah. And it was cobwebs over there. And now, you must understand, this is early in the morning. Right? This is like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I'm looking out, and finally I open, I would say like a half an inch that I see the sunlight, I mean sunlight, the daylight time, and then five, you know, summer is already 5:30, and 5:30 in the morning is the sun out, not the sun out, but you see the daylight. I look, I see pavement, I see a street, the side street. I said, this is it. But I look in the side, very narrow, and I see a sentry going. So what happened is, this is the entrance. We were in the opposite of the army camp, and there's two sentries going. One starts on this side, and one starts in this corner. And they meet together. They turn around. They go back. Then they turn around. You know, like the palace guards. They're coming back. They meet each other. They turn around and go back. And I observed that, and I said, no people in the street. That's dangerous. You walk out from here. Now, we knew that by 8 o'clock, when they say 8, it could be 9, 10, we have to, they're going to look for us. We have to assemble there and march out, go on the victorious war. So, I'm waiting until people are start coming up on the streets. They want to see more people walking on the streets. So, I said to the guys like this, look, you have one chance to leave. If you listen to me, organize. Anybody who is not going to listen to me, you know you get shot on the spot. So be organized and listen very carefully. We have to wait until the day is going to be more public, more traffic. So we waited maybe an hour and a half or so on, like 7:30 in the morning, and we saw traffic. Women going to work and men and whatever, children go to school. Those sentries are going to stay. We didn't know when they changed the sentries, but I sat like this. I opened again and I looked in the sentry. But we could hear the sentry from going by. So I knew now that he's their way.
Separated.
That must have been the center of that wall. I says, look, I think to myself, why should I be the first? I get shot. And besides, if I go as the first, they will be very disorganized in the back.
Mm-hmm.
They will run out like rabbits behind me. We all get shot.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two points which I made me be the last one. I will organize them in a quiet way. They should go out one by one. And I'd be the last one. I know no one is behind me rushing or
creating
this stuff. And this is what I did.
They agreed?
They agreed. And I said, good luck. They shook hands. I said, from very different towns. They were Ukrainians from different towns.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care what happened, that they participated in matters or their parents, or whatever. They were all youngsters. But we were in the same fate. We had the same destiny at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened it. The other sentries were parting and going to their post, to their corners. I opened the door and said, you, just go over, don't run, go in the middle of the street and you walk. And as we came back, this took about a good half hour. And then one left, one right, one left, one right. I was the last one. Same thing, open. And I remember when I walked out from there, the two doors, to see them on the inside, I could hold the doors back. The doors.
Five, side two, continuing our interview with Mr. Snyder.
Okay.
So how did you get through?
Okay. As I walked out from there, you must understand, my head was shaved, I was in a shabby uniform, and I was walking very quietly with a fear that any time I will hear a man stop, but I did that, the sound did not come.
Didn't happen.
Whatever.
You got lost in the traffic.
I got lost in the traffic, and I walked straight to my aunt, which was the mother of my cousin, the dentist. And I walked in, and she says, you know, my mother, she said, your mother, my mother is trying to give somebody 1,000 rubles to take you out from there.
Mm.
And I think she gave the deposit or something, and she did. But the money was lost.
Mm.
Somebody who knows somebody, or officer who likes to drink and so on. But anyway, you're out, thank God. Now what?
No.
Cannot stay here.
You're still in uniform.
Yes, cannot stay here. Take out the uniform, give you some shorts. And,
but your head is shaved.
That's the one mark which
yeah.
I put a hat on, a sport hat on my head. You cannot stay here.
Mm.
I'd notify your mother. She ran to my mother, told my mother, I was very thrilled. And my family knew for my life, and I'm out.
Mm.
And she spelled the thousand rubles gone for good. Now we have to find a place that we can hide you out.
Mm-hmm.
But this was in October. So whatever we tried, not one member of the family was afraid to take us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get shot. So they finally found a woman. Actually, I was over a cousin's, an elderly cousin, but she was afraid too, because frequent, she used to have some commissars coming over there, because her brother worked in a forest. He was like a manager in a forest, and the commissar used to come for dinner, so she was afraid. So finally, they found a woman who her husband and her son was on the battlefront. Mm-hmm. They were taken into the army, and she had a daughter, one daughter, 14, 15-year-old daughter, and she's in need. She can use the money. So my mother told her she would pay her. I don't remember how much, like 100 rubles for a day, and supplies and food to keep me in hiding. And there I was in hiding. October, November, it was the end of October, I would say. I would say November, December, January, February. For 4 months I was in hiding.
Didn't dare go out.
Oh, no.
Now you knew.
There I was in hiding. And that she lived on the first floor, and on the front there was a clinic, a regular clinic, where a lot of Russian, not army, but Russian officials, police used to come to that clinic. They used to park their jeeps and jeeps, and army cars and so on, in that courtyard. So I was in hiding in a room, in a dark room, and no one used to come into the house. And sometimes it became so dangerous because sometimes they wanted to come in and drink water or need water for their radiator. Mm. So it became dangerous later, about 6-7 weeks later. The chief sent me up to the second floor, where a woman lived over there. Her husband worked in the railroad, like I said. He wasn't taken to the army. He was a railroad specialist. They needed him for the railroad. Mm-hmm. He was all day away, and she used to hide me on the second floor. Night I used to come sleep downstairs. Until they made my preparation to get me out from there to Romania, across the border.
This is still Bukovina.
Chernivtsi.
This
was Russia.
This is now Russia.
Russia. Now get me over to Romania. Now, in the meantime, Warsaw fell, Budapest fell, Kainzburg fell, the Germans were almost crushed, the Russians were already by the outskirts of Berlin, the Allies were closer in. I mean, it was nothing, remember, it's a month before victory, and a lot of troops came back. In the meantime, they already decimated all those Banderovs, those bandits. They cleaned them up, they deported their wives and children all to Russia, relocated to whole villages, deported, you know, they're specialists in deporting. They relocated, brought Russian families in here and took out, I would say, three-quarter or half of the Ukrainian population they deported back to Russia because they didn't trust me anymore. So I was close to, we knew the victory was going to come any day, but I had to get out from there in that tumult, in that confusion across the border. And this is where my mother negotiated. And in the meantime, more refugees came back from concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as from Auschwitz and from Buchenwald and from Transnistria, people were wandering around like skeletons looking for families for leftovers. And it was coming and going and coming and going. And my mother, you know, you must understand, there were other guys who were doing this, false documents, connections. They were
forging
documents, working with Zionist organization or individuals. And
what was her contact?
Her contact was with somebody who forged my documents, made me under the name Ruby Weisberg, a youngster who was born in Suceava. Suceava was South Bukovina, was already belonged
Romania.
To Romania.
Old Romania.
Across the border.
Uh-huh.
And
how about
that
herself?
Hmm?
What about herself?
Nothing. She stayed there. She wasn't in danger. I wasn't in danger.
She wasn't in danger.
I was when the NKVD were there, the KGB would catch me, they shoot me in the spot. So she made the papers like I was Ruby Weisberg.
Mm-hmm.
Ruby Weisberg. And I was born in Suceava,
mm-hmm.
the same age.
Mm-hmm.
Ruby Weisberg really lived in Suceava.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he died
in
concentration camp with his entire family. But I was the Ruby Weisberg who actually survived. My family all perished. And I'm going back to Suceava. I'm coming from concentration camp as a skeleton, you know, as a survivor. But even that was dangerous because they still can capture you and put you in the army.
Yeah.
So I was given this document, and I was with a contact to a peasant, taken to another town, and in that town I had Ozu, my cousin, who also worked as a manager, it means a manager, a manager of a big, big farms over there. And he kept me there close. It was not, it was about 5 miles from the border, and I stayed with him there as his assistant there.
How did you get there? You walked?
No. How I walked there? With a train. I went with a train there, very simple. With a train, I'm the Ruby Weisberg.
Your hair was already grown.
Yes, and I'm a Ruby Weisberg, that's all. Nathan Schneider doesn't Weisberg. Exist anymore. And I was stopped many times. Many times I was stopped, and I showed my papers, and and I got through, and I lived there for about a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was arrangements made with a peasant, on which you got all this was a whole organization.
What your mother worked
at? Yeah, worked out. And I was gone there officially, not under the stroller, sitting on there and going across the border. And came to the border, and I had to show the papers, but I'm Ruby Weisberg, I'm going home, I'm coming from concentration camp. And this is when I crossed the border to Romania, and that was a hassle by itself, because they had to stop us and for hours, and they searched the wagon and searched that, and there were a lot of refugees from Romania who came back from Transnistria, going back into old Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Who don't live in the Bukovina and the Russia. So
mm-hmm.
they claimed they were Romanian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a whole group of people over there, and I lived under the Ruby Weisberg, and I succeeded.
With whom? Did you stay with someone? Or
no, I crossed the border.
Did you have someone?
And I did not stay in Suceava. Oh, no. Because in Suceava, somebody from the authorities would say, Ruby Weisberg didn't look like you.
No.
So I, you know, I was registered there.
But you had to move on.
I had to move on. Because his name was there, but he still lived there.
Somebody
right?
could have.
So I, from there, I went straight down to Bucharest.
Mm-hmm.
I took the train. This was already, in the meantime, peace came.
Mm-hmm.
It was after May, like it was May, June. I came straight down to the train officially and took the train down to Bucharest.
Mm-hmm.
And Bucharest was the main Zionist nucleus organization, which per preparation for Israel.
And that's what you intended to do? Did you work this out with mother too?
Yes.
That's what you
I wanted to go.
You
yes.
wanted to go?
Yes.
And she would then try to?
Yes. That I, my aim is to get out from there, because we knew that even the king abdicated the king of Romania, and then it became, and Romania became like a socialist, not a communist government, but a socialist government, and the prime minister was a Jewish woman. I forgot the name. She
Anna.
Anna Tauber, Tuber or something.
She was killed later.
Yes. And it was like this.
Mm-hmm.
It was very bad for the rich, but it wasn't, it was better for the poor, and it was more equal. It was a socialism, not communism.
Mm-hmm.
Equality, and they were hunting.
Was it Anna Pocker?
Anna Pocker. They were hunting down Nazis back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and those criminals, the Romanian, who did, and prisoners came back from Russia. Romanian
wasn't under the Russian.
No, it was
not,
terrible.
Not
later, 2 years later, it became really, Clinton became a communist government,
mm-hmm.
a satellite, but it wasn't a satellite in that year. So Zionism was open, free.
Mm-hmm.
I would say 1945, 46, up to 47, Zionists flourished all over.
Mm-hmm.
There were from Palestine, Shlichim coming over and organized Hashemerot here and Hanorot here and Gordonian and Buseli and Algeman and Mizrahi.
Yeah, but the English didn't let them in yet.
Yeah, but they were organizing. Now Israel, from Palestine, different Shlichim came over. Israel was not born at that time, because Israel was born in 48, but there were movements and transport. They were trying to get Jews out as much as survivors left over from the Holocaust, from concentration camps, from Hungary, Czechoslovakia, from whatever they can get from Romania out into illegal, naturally the English didn't allow it, into Palestine. And I was in Bucharest, and I went to live with one of my cousins, which is her father and my father were brothers.
Mm-hmm.
My father had two brothers. I'm sorry. her mother was a sister to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
My father had two brothers, and they were deported with their wives and children to the concentration camp of Transnistria. But they were very neat and very obvious, clean, and they couldn't take the lice, the bacteria, and the dysentery, and all that sickness. They committed suicide. They threw themselves in a well, and I was told later, in a big well, they threw themselves. Those old-fashioned wells, that you bring it up and a chain of water, they committed suicide because they could not take that life. So nobody was left on my father's side, except for my father had older sister, and this is her daughter, who lived in Bucharest. She lived there all her life.
She wasn't hurt.
No, she wasn't hurt. Her husband was a stockbroker, had a beautiful home there. Her son lives now in Israel. He was at that time studying to become an engineer, and I lived there. It was my first freedom. Do whatever you want to, don't care, and go to movies and enjoy life. What do you want to do with yourself? When you go to college, you want to go to college and study and become something? I said, no, I wanted to go to Israel. I want to go to Palestine and fight. Now we don't have the Nazis, we fight the English because the English don't give us a land, and I was influenced all this before. So I joined some organizations, and naturally, Betar organization was at that time the choice, Tosa between Betar and the Ben Gurion's party, which was Grodonia, Mapai. So I joined a group. Which was Betar, not realizing at the time it was part of the Gun Tzvai Lomi, which Begin was the leader. And we had about stories, they blown up and the borders going on and so on. And they took us on a special camp to train us to fight. And then I told them I was in the demolition squad, and they can use me for that, sure.
Perfect.
So they took us up in Transylvania, because Transylvania belongs to Romania now. They took it away from Hungary because Romania joined the Allies, so they gave him back everything, you know, except northern
Ukraine
and Bosnia. They didn't have. So I went to Transylvania, in some place in the mountains, we had a camp, what we call it like a summer camp, in top mountains, and there they trained us, and they called us madrichim,
teachers,
how to teach others, and they taught us judo, knives, demolition. Small arms,
sharp shooting,
rope climbing, all kinds of hand-to-hand fights. In our personal madriach was a man by the name, Yehuda Avriel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yehuda Avriel plays a big chapter in the Israeli history. Yehuda Avriel was born in Austria. He was a solid guy, husky guy, with blonde hair, reddish hair, who came as a child to Israel, and naturally he joined the underground organization. Later I understand that he was an emissary of Ben Gurion, you read in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Gurion sent him to buy weapons
to Europe. Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia, to buy weapons, and while he was in Czechoslovakia, he also came to be our madriach. Not day by day, but he was like every other day he was there. He personally gave us judo lessons. And I remember I had a combat fight with him. He was a husky guy. And
I am not
a story. Oh, yes.
I read that in all the books.
Yeah. Certainly, Avriel.
That Yehuda Avriel saved me, but helped me a lot 8 years later.
In Israel.
In Israel, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to come to the United States with American Embassy. Because of my two names, Bryce the Kruger, United and Snyder, he's the one who helped me.
Mm.
At that time, he was Secretary of State. At that time, for a short while, in Jerusalem.
Was he ambassador to Israel?
Oh, he was ambassador later when Israel became
a
state. He was the first ambassador to Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was stationed there. But we were there having a good time. We were trained, really. I remember we had all kinds of exercises with the head, hands tied together. Our head was trained to open doors in case your prison is about to escape. And knife throwing, I mean, we were the best knife throwers. I had calluses all over my muscles. I mean, we were like, they made us some fighting machines.
Mm.
And we were two girls. and about 18 guys, 20 of us, and we said we are going to be Madrachim when we come to Israel. When we come to Israel, before the English, when Israel will be born as a state, and we come naturally. We suppose our aim was to come there to fight the English before Israel comes to be their state. We automatically will be officers. We will be the honorary trained officers in the Israeli army. And we will train others. And all the people organize the illegal aliyah throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we send us to Italy, to Austria, to Czechoslovakia, to organize how to get illegal to with trains and ships into and so on.
How long did you stay in Transylvania? In the
We stayed there for about 4 or 5 months. Good food, and we ate, and we had a nice stream over there, and on top of the mountains, and we could shoot, and everything, no one could come, it was on top of the mountain. And when somebody came through, we said we were at a summer camp. And only a hunter could come there, because there was no, when we were on the top of the peak, we could look down, the rest of the mountains looked valid. I mean, very, very tough. We had to climb for 4 or 5 hours to the top plateau, to that plateau. And it was in not too far from Kolozsvár. Kolozsvár, Klausenburg, which is and it was very, very high. But from there, we had to travel with there with a mountain train. I remember a small mountain train. And from there, we took another little transportation. And then we walked for a day. And then another 4 hours climbing. So it was out of civilization. And this is where we had our camp. And actually, for the government, it was illegal because we trained to be terrorists, soldiers.
Yeah.
But so I had me helped a lot being I was selected because of that being
experience
in demolition and so on. And this is where we stand over there. And then after we were finished up the course, they send us to different towns. I went to Temeswar to organize there a group, and some went to Bucharest back, and some went to Yashi, and all kinds of cities, Satmar, and
to organize other Zionist groups.
Yes. In the meantime, Betar itself did not have Chalutim Hakshara.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly they were from Mapai and Mapam and Agudat Israel. They have the Hakshara, which means the being the future Chalutim for the future pioneers of Israel. And this is 46. My mother came in 46 over the border illegally. Because they let all the Jews who wanted to leave for some reason, you had to pay some money there, but most of the Jews left Germany. It's not like today in Russia, but they let everybody go.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody wants to go. So my mother and my sister and my uncle, they all came and they settled in Kolozsvár, which is Kolozsvár, they lived there until they came to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not too far from my mother. Now I lived in the Ruby Weisberg, not Nathan Schneider.
Mm-hmm.
So I came there as a cousin. I wasn't their son. No one from the neighborhood knew that because I was afraid.
Yeah.
Slowly, the government in Romania became more communistic, more taken over the Russians, more controlled by the Russians. And then Anna Parker left, and someone, not Ceausescu now, but somebody else came there, and it was really became like terror. It became a totalitarian regime.
Mm-hmm.
And I was participating, taking part in different groups of Aliyah, and as a matter of fact, we escorted a couple of groups to Constanza, but we didn't go. Because our aim is to...
And that was illegal by this time, I suppose, wasn't it?
It was legal for the Romanian government, but illegal for the English. They didn't want the English to find out.
But
we used to transport them and to show them how quiet they have to be in going. That those boats were not actually in the main port, but they were outside. They were going with little barges and find the boat. Some were going to Yugoslavia, Belgrade, to Trieste, to Italy. Some were going to Budapest, Hungary, Vienna, and then Italy. So every point leads to Jerusalem, let me say. And there were a lot of aliyahs. And I said, when are we going to go? They said, you are the one, the main guys you have to organize, the others should go. And in thousands then, this is where Cyprus was filled up. With all the Jews mostly from Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Cyprus was built up with all the Jews came from Romania who were caught illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, not all of them, but maybe a quarter of the Cyprus Jews were the one which I escorted with their
friends.
And my heart was breaking. I had to take him and then come back.
Yep.
They were gone. I said, goodbye, good luck, and I had to go back because more others had to come. And this was going on until the government started clamping down, and one day they made Zionist organizations, Zionist movements illegal. This has happened in 1947. It became a real communistic authoritarian dictatorship.
And you were
still... They declared illegal. Naturally. But it won't disappear overnight, Zionism or the Zionist organization, so they went underground. So they went underground. And at that time, I joined a Hakshara group. And I was afraid to go to my mother now, too much. I used to come as a visitor there. And there were a lot of Romanian Jews from Chernivtsi who lived in Kolozsvár, were waiting for their come to Israel. You had to have a passport, and you had to pay so much money to get authorization, illegally, to leave from Israel, from Romania, to go to to Israel. Now, Israel was not born at that time. So this is 1948. But in the meantime, it became illegal to be a Zionist there. So I had to join a Hashara group. And I joined the Hashara group in Bucharest. I figured it's better for me to be in a big city because, like I said, we had the lessons from during the war. In a big city, you get lost in the crowd. And this was supported by the Zionist organization from Palestine. We had help from joint distribution. We got a lot of help. The packages came from the United States. Most of the food was in the United States. We had to go and work. And we lived in a nice mansion outside the city. And we had our own songs and dances, and we learned Hebrew, and we learned. We had all kinds of lecturers. Madrasin used to come there from different kibbutzim, from the Gani Alef and the Gani Beit, and from all kinds of places. And they were telling us about the story and learning about all the lectures and history and so on. And it became more bad, worse and worse and worse for the Zionist organization because they really clamped in and tightened up. And then they made restrictions of quotas of leaving the country. And Israel became a state in 48. And Avriel, Yehud Avriel, became the first ambassador in Israel. He didn't have to go too far. He just stayed there, and then he says, look, just take over the embassy.
Change your clothes.
Yeah. Change your clothes. And he became the first ambassador, and actually was celebrated. It was in May of 1948, and we all celebrated and so on. The Zionist organization became illegal underground.
Even though Romania recognized
sure,
the
but
state,
yeah.
But the Zionist movement was illegal.
It was like a decadent.
It was decadent. It was pressure from Russia. So naturally we had to go underground, dissolve that place completely, and some of our group members did leave.
Did leave.
Because so many places were there. Now we supposed to go in one transport. We were ready, 4 o'clock, supposed to go with a train. It wasn't more legal, it was illegal. In a train, I remember, we supposed to meet in a small little, like a 10 kilometers outside the city, we will board that train, which goes actually, from there we go to Temeswar, Timișoara, from Bucharest to Timișoara. From Timișoara we will illegally cross the border to Yugoslavia, which we had already there, people already waiting for us from the border. There was agents all over, yeah. From there we will go in Yugoslavia through to Italy, and that border will be already, we go straight, and there's a ship waiting for us, and we go, we get caught. And 4 o'clock we're supposed to leave, and 12 o'clock one of our Maharaj chiefs came in and says, sorry, but you're not going to go. And I said, why? I mean, we did our duty. He says, your places are sold. I says, what do you mean you're sold? Even here? He says, we sold your places for a lot of thousands of dollars because we need money. That money we need, I don't know for what reason, for ships, for weapons, so that's the reason we sold your places. As a good patriot, remember, we did not do it to put it in our pocket. Your place is like a very rich Jew wants to go, he paid $10,000. Let me go. So that's the reason our places were sold, and we were very upset. I mean, you told us, we were waiting for so long, we helped others, now we cannot go out. I had to run, because my name was in danger. And I know from experience, as soon as it becomes more totalitarian, they will have the KGB here, and maybe Nathan Snyder is a deserter, and they're looking for him. And how long can I survive under Ruby Weisberg? I was in danger, so I had to run. So I had no place to go. My mother used to say, don't come anymore here, you're endangering us. So I used to go there, like stay for a couple hours and come back. I did some black market in the meantime with one of my cousins, a professor, which is now in Israel, with salamis and butters and all that, from college bar back and here and so on, traveled around the country. But then I was told that they tightened up so much that you couldn't walk on the street without having a labor pass. You have to work someplace. Mm-hmm. And you don't work someplace, you go and you are called a hooligan,
parasite, yes.
And they take you to a labor camp, which was under Danubio. They used to build big dams over there, and all the parasites go to work there. You have to have, I didn't have a job. I couldn't work someplace. So, finally, a friend of mine and I, Robert Label, right? He was one of the top madrasim in the organization, the Zionist organization. And he got a job in Bucharest in the Ministry of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And he took me in there to work. So somehow he took me in there to work. And we started both off as clerks in the stationery department to give us stationaries. By the time we disappeared from there, I was head of the department, he was head of the department. I was on the Vice Bakrubi and he was on the Robert Label. That bluff that we played there is unbelievable. First of all, you know, when you get a job there with the government, you have to have autobiography. My autobiography was the following.
I don't think we'll have time for that, and I want to get the end.
That my father was a shoemaker. Uh-huh. My mother used to go from home to home washing clothes. You know, she was a bashering. Yes. I was very, very poor, and I come from Suchava. And it so happened that the Weisbergs were very poor people. And I was in concentration camp and so on. They made me a proletariat. I said, they wanted to write me in, to sign me up in the Young Komsomol. And he made another story, too.
All fabricated.
Fabricated story. And I bluffed him so much that we came to meetings, and I had to tell him my life story. And I was a double agent, like I was
I
lived with him in an apartment, and he said, "How much could we blow? How many times can we blow them? One day they will
make a mistake."
My name, I have a picture now. I look like a proletariat. My name was every week on the workers' employees bulletin.
Oh my goodness!
I had the name of there. The man of the year, the man of the month, the man of the month of the day.
Proletarian hero.
Right, right. And I loved him so much, and then I got word that you're taking your chance in your own hand, disappear.
From the Zionist movement?
No.
You were?
No, disappear from that job.
Who warned you?
The Zionist movement.
The Zionist, what I meant, yes.
Disappear, yes. Both of us.
Too much.
Disappear, take off, just one day don't go into work, let me look for you, okay? We both wind up in the Israeli consulate.
In the Israeli consulate?
We took refuge.
And you got immunity?
No, they didn't know we are there.
You hid there?
We walked in and we never walked out until the day I left.
Which was when?
1951.
So you had to stay in Romania then another 3 years?
3 years you went to come to?
No, I wasn't. I was off and on.
But
I left and out and, you know, I went No, this wasn't 48, I'm sorry, but the Israeli government was recognized in 48, correct?
Mm-hmm.
49, 50. I was about 1 year.
Because you worked in the
store. 1 year.
One
I was.
Year.
1 year I was there in hiding. Who was the ambassador? You were Abriel. I used to drink Israeli wine, I used to be in the basement, they had all the machineries, you know, all those communication and so on. I was trusted.